Colin Davis, your Mozart with the Boston Orchestra and audience somehow got to the core of Mozart, maybe, but surely of the audience. Could you say what was going on last night, especially in the piano concerto?
Well, I hoped what was going on generally was we were making music. I mean, that orchestra can play anything, and we understand the language of these wonderful men, and so that's the game. It's the game of the time and the dynamic and the phrasing and the whole works that goes into making music. And I think that that's something that people actually enjoy hearing and maybe seeing it happen. Mm. It's this game between people who know what they're doing, and it's a game of discovering the possibilities of this this extraordinary immaterial and yet completely plastic material.
It's a game also between light and darkness, especially in Mozart, and from the slow movement to the third, so many colors are changing.
Well, that, of course, is part of the game, isn't it? I mean, you're drawing on all the things in one another, if you understand. You know, and Mozart is the supreme genius at that. Mm. He calls attention to dark things, but he doesn't get obsessed by them, as some other composers do, and they just can't stop telling you.
Well, that's the trick, and I want you to unfold it somehow, or translate it.
Well, all I can say, all I say to musicians is listen to the music, and it will tell you how it goes. And it's not a cop-out, what I'm saying. It's really, really true. Musicians worrying about the notes, you know, playing them in tune and all that, and then the conductors say, oh, I wonder what the tempo is. It's waiting for you. Just listen, man.
Did you always feel that way? Or does this come with mastery?
No, it kind of revealed itself gradually that most of the things that I was worrying about were completely irrelevant. And it may have something to do with the fact that I sleep with my Alexander technique teacher, you see. My wife teaches Alexander technique. And she got that off me because when I was a young man, there was an English conductor called Adrian Bolt. And he came to a concert and he said, oh, my dear boy, you'll be a cripple if you go on like that. I'll send you to someone. So he did, and I was about 28. And then when my wife married, she said, what the hell are you doing lying on the floor all the time? So I said what it was. And she got interested. And when the children were grown up, she took a three-year course, and now she teaches. And the interesting about Alexander technique is, I mean, a thousand of interesting, but you let things happen. You don't, if you start doing things, you screw up. You let your, you know. She will come along to you and pick up your arm. If you give it to her, say, don't do that. What are you doing that for? I'm going to have it. So you have, therefore, to have your arm completely relaxed. And if you, when you begin to get the feeling that you don't have to get like this, there's a chance that you might be able to hear the music.
I didn't know that about you, that you were Alexander Technique, but I watched your left hand, I watched your eyebrows. You seemed so supple, so relaxed, and the players knew it. The players were tuned into all of it, I think.
Well, that's another way of how you get along with people, isn't it? I mean, orchestra musicians have quite a tough life. And they're perpetually on trial. And if the man in front makes them more tense, the worse it is for them. The whole scheme is aimed at freedom. Not absolute freedom, which is panic, because you don't know, what to do at all. But you've got a framework. You've got this beautiful score laid out by the composer. But within that, the freedom is there to play it and to respond to it and to not to worry about... Am I doing it he wants? Am I playing with anybody else? Am I doing this or that? I told them the rehearsal. I said, the idea is you'll be absolutely free to play. You know this piece? Well, let's play it. Tell them how to play it. Just if things aren't quite right, you point it out this or that. But the idea is to get them relaxed so they don't screw themselves into some spastic.
There's almost a worldview in that notion of letting things happen, being ready, but being relaxed, not being resigned, but being supple. How far can you take it?
Take it as far as you can. See where you get. I mean, you never know where the limits are, do you? As William Blake said, if you don't go too far, you don't know when to stop.
You don't know where you should have stopped.
Well, you find out soon enough.
on the Mozart, listening to your Mozart, I was drawn back to a book that I read indirectly because of you, kind of an obscure classic, The Death of Virgil by Hermann Broch. And it's about literally the great Augustan Roman poet in the last, 48 hours of his life, wanting to destroy his greatest work, thinking about everything. But he says, among many other things, and it seemed to me there was a lot of Mozart in this, "Oh, earthly life, the diaphanous world and the world of darkness inhaling and exhaling unceasingly, floating between the twin seductions of too much or too little shadow, etc." He says, "Oh, human perception, not yet become knowledge, no longer instinct, rising from the humus of existence," this kind of organic stuff of living and recently living and will be living again. He says, "Oh, human knowledge, unrooted, eternally in motion, neither in the depths nor in the heights, but hovering forever over the starry threshold between night and day.
No longer, but not yet." Yes.
That's your man, Hermann Broch. And I wondered, how close is that to what you're pulling out of the Mozart?
Well, I don't know. The book had a great influence on me. There's that a fantastic, I don't know, if you've got to the end of it.
Recently.
The interview between Virgil and Augustus, when Virgil is saying, "But you're not talking about what I'm talking about," and Augustus doesn't want to hear it anyway. He wants his poem because he is the emperor and he's the great guy. And Virgil is dying and said, "But I've been wasting my time writing all this stuff. I would wish I'd made one useful human gesture." I think that was one of the things that really hit me. It's making the human gesture, not for television or publicity, not wanting to be a celebrity, but just, with all the experience and knowledge that he had. He was a very learned man, and he studied all kinds of things. But he wanted to use that for something which was not just in support of Augustus' idea of an empire.
I've never interviewed anybody about the death of Virgil before, and you probably don't talk about it every day, so this is kind of uncharted territory. But Broch was the author, was a Mozartian. He was, he felt that Mozart had made one of the great gestures that dealt with with everything. Is there any, do you feel that connection?
Yes, I think he was a, in spite of the length of his book and the complexity of the language, he was trying to say what only music can actually say. Mm. Although you can say music says nothing. And it is each man's subjective interpretation of music which causes him to get excited about it or not. But if you're listening to that piano concerto, here's a man who is just so intellectually unassailable that he's never at a loss to know what comes next. So you can't even feel it's being composed. I think that, as you do notice in other pieces of music by other men. And that is why there's a kind of, you know, there's a kind of divinity about Mozart in this sense. And I think that he, that's what he's talking about. Mozart isn't, you can't say that concerto would be a great public piece for the Emperor Joseph. What it is, I don't know, but there, in the slow movement, there is a, there's an aria of a comprehensive melancholy which is untouchable. And the consolation of a, that little serenade in A major in the middle, which is almost too much. too much for me anyway. And then there's when he's lying ill and he comes and he talks about the woman he loved. And he hadn't really loved her. He was, and he comes to the conclusion that actually love is the only thing. And he's left it too late. But all that's tied up with the supposed a prophecy about Christ, which comes in the, one of the Georgics. And so the book is in a way a premonition of the coming of Christ. Mm. I don't know. We could talk for years about this. Mm.
But everything in the book about laughter and song and childhood has this Mozartian ring about it in Hermann Brock. He speaks.
Well, that's understandable because what strikes one about Mozart is his failure to become a mature person, as the world would put it. He kept his childlike reaction to everything, sadness and tragedy and everything. But his reactions are so true and genuine. And they come from, I don't know, there were the ideas hanging around there, Enlightenment and Freemasonry and all that. But his operas are mostly about reconciliation. In fact, he sets off where Shakespeare finished with The Tempest and Cymbeline and so on. And he has, therefore, in his, for instance, at the end of Figaro, the hymn to peace, he's got that ability to speak for the ideal that we all desperately need. Mm.
Where did Colin Davis learn the vitality or the meaning or the possibility of that, the human gesture?
I don't know. I don't really know what you mean. Except
I mean, out of your own experience, out of your own lifetime, when did that begin to dawn, that it was about a human gesture in the end?
It came much later. To begin with, my passion for music was so intolerable, I suppose. It was only gradually trying to do this kind of job, working with a lot of other musicians, that it turned round from domination and telling people what to do to trying to, very much as comes in Virgil, to make this nothing to do with tyranny and fear, because no good music ever came out of any of that, I don't think. You listen to the great dominating maestros. I mean, if you listen to Toscanini's Verdi Requiem, I mean, it's amazingly disciplined, but it's completely heartless to me. You know, that is a fantastic piece. And all that is in it cannot come from the will to dominate other people. So that had to go, you know. And when it's a big problem for yourself, you can only nibble away at it gradually, you know, like a sort of miniature beaver, until the edifice collapses and you don't want any more to do with that. But, of course, there are a lot of people who wouldn't accept that. But I'm still there. That's all I can say.
Who wouldn't accept the non-imperial conductor? Who's propping up the imperial conductor?
There's some people who have a kind of Jehovah complex. They want to be dominated. They want to be told what to do, so they don't have to be responsible. Now, I don't think great music is made like that. When everyone in the orchestra feels responsible for this piece of music, that's when the life begins.
This is so interesting. I mean, you're talking about music. You're talking about your life. You may be talking about a parable of what we wish were a post-imperial world. But stick with the music in your own life. You had your imperial or imperious youth. And you survived somehow being, you got over being a young superstar, and you had a second chance as a, what should we say, an Olympian, post-super genuine star or something. But when I think of your career from the 40s on, you were the. The great sprinter of your youth, and somehow managed to get through it and past it. How did that happen?
Heaven only knows.
You know what I mean?
I remember a landmark in it. We were at the Promenade concerts in London. You know about those that happen every year. And that big party that takes place at the end, which is called the Last Night of the Proms. And I did that for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then I suddenly realized I didn't want to do that anymore. This had nothing to do with music at all. This was just, I don't know, a great sort of publicity stunt, and I didn't want to go down that road. I really wanted to be a musician, and serious musician, and not to be a success. In that sense, I still don't like. I didn't want to be a success. I want to make the most beautiful music possible. But that maybe didn't happen in 5 minutes. Maybe it was a big crisis in the middle of my life. I think, not the middle. Well, maybe about the middle. You know, about 35. And I didn't like the life I was leading. My first marriage had gone completely to pieces, and I had to start again. And one of the things I did, this is interesting for anybody, I don't know. I talked a lot to my mother and my sisters, and I went back to the places I remembered as a kid because they told me that I was a very, very jolly child up to the age of about five. So there must be somewhere. Things like that don't disappear, you know. They lie at the bottom of a pile of rubbish which you've thrown on it. Mm. And so I went back to try and find that spring of natural good nature, natural peace with the little world of a child of five. And I got married again, and then we had five children, and they all play musical instruments, and it really dates from then that I... Mm. Even then I had to... There were still remains of the fiery, intolerant, bad-tempered fellow. But the one thing I hung on to was music.
Mm.
And that's not to exploit music, but to really try to get as far as they could to the essence of it. And I was very lucky when I was young because I played with what I thought were great artists like Menuhin, Claudio Arrau, and Gil Els, and Clifford Curzon, and all these. I was a young man of 35, 40, and they were the great men. I mean, Arrau was never satisfied with what he did.
Mm.
David Oistrakh was another one. What a lovely man he was. And they were humble. They never tried to behave like celebrities, which is what everybody tries to do now. Mm. So they can announce the lack of news on the television.
Mm.
Anyway, that's enough of that. It gives you an idea. The other thing is I read incessantly. I'm still reading incessantly. I think if you stop reading, your mind just closes down.
Hmm. What do you read besides Herman Brock?
Well, I've had a big year. I read the whole of Dickens.
My!
Because I'd never read any. I got very, very excited, and a fantastic man. And now I am into Balzac. Now, that's a very good exercise, because there's over 80 novels, and I'm not likely to get past 25 in my life, I don't think. So, and so on. One's pushing one's in ignorance as far as it will go. And also when I was in Munich, I read German for about 20 years because I really wanted to find out about that language. I read a lot, lots and lots of German literature. So anyway, that's...
Can I digress? You also knit. You're a world-class knitter.
I don't know about that, but I do knit.
This is a full life. What does the knitting knit together?
Well, it's if you examine what knitting is, it's rather odd. It's like cell division. You put your needle into the stitch, and it grows. And there's some evidence that you've done something.
Mm.
Whereas your music is gone, we don't know where, at least. If I knit a complicated flowered cardigan for my wife, it's nice to see her walking about in it.
Mm.
And so I knitted Mitsuko a jumper this time. Yeah, I was never allowed to knit for any other women but my wife, but we made an exception for Mitsuko.
This is a whole lot of stuff to be doing in one life. Come back to the matter of letting go of the power of the conductor and getting off the power trip. I mean, isn't this what the world has got to do too, and maybe the United States of America and your the Blair faction in England? What's are the connections to be made here? I mean, Britain, we thought, was off its imperial head and better off for it. Where are we now in the world?
Well, you tell me. These two demons, power and money, are running the show, and they've gone mad, I think. And they're finding that it isn't actually as easy as all that. Mm. People are losing phenomenal sums of money at the moment, and the idea that if you've got money, you've got power, is just a false value, I think. Those are the two things that really you have to tackle if you want to be a human being. You've got to come to grips with not wanting power over other people and not working for money. Take the Mitsuko Uchida and myself. We never pursued money, but somehow we acquired plenty, and it's very nice to be able to look after one's children. It's especially nice to know that you can look after yourself in your old age and not be dependent on other people. But that wasn't the idea. She doesn't pursue fame. She's one of the greatest pianists around, but she doesn't behave like that. And I try not to. Not interested in it.
How do great nations come to grips with that?
Well, they don't, do they? And the more you read, the more you realize that it's never been any different. Reading Balzac, where the pursuit of money is paramount, and with Dickens the same. In the 18th century, if you didn't have money, if you weren't a gentleman, which means you were a bloody nuisance because you had enough money not to do anything, and men hanging around with nothing to do are bound to make trouble. But see, I think for the private person, to strut around the town and to admire yourself when you shave in the morning is really the catastrophe for a human being. Mm-hmm. And as somebody, lovely German, wrote about Odysseus, when he'd come home and there was Penelope and he was talking about his great adventures, and she said, "There's no room in my kitchen for heroes."
Well, she didn't recognize him when he came home either, which set the table in its own way.
He looked pretty scruffy.
You travel the world like a musical great teacher and diplomat and performer. What's the progress of these ideas, these Mozartian notions in the wider world, you think?
I have no idea. I don't think anybody takes any notice of it at all. Mm. It only works in this little kingdom that we inhabit. See, this is another, of course, obvious point. The leaders of the world sit in their offices. They haven't the faintest idea what anybody else does at all, and they haven't got time to find out. Mm. Our little kingdom, it consists at its greatest of no more than 1,000 people. I mean, if you're going to do the Berlioz Requiem, you might have 700 or 800 people there. A little orchestra is something you can know the people in it. You can appreciate them as individuals. And so what you believe in has the possibility of functioning, if you believe in anything. Mm. But it has no function outside. Of course it doesn't. Musicians are hardly socially acceptable. They never were, and I don't think it's changed much.
What's the irony score on that line? Does one hope to change the world with this sort of music or not?
No, but as long as people come and hear it, they would take something away. And a lot of people do come. As many people come to concerts, I'm told, as go to football matches. Mm. But you wouldn't think so. Because the attention of the world is not focused on the possible message of somebody like Mozart. What are they interested in?
Do you worry about the audiences or not? I must say I watched the audience for your Mozart and Schubert, and I thought, my God, it's a bumper crop of people being profoundly fed, leaving better than they came, and what's to worry about? But I wonder how you see the serious musical audience these days.
Well, I thought what pleased me was how many people were there last night. If we have an open rehearsal in London, you don't get that. Nobody comes. But we get good audiences for our concerts. And that's all we can hope for. But it's all in the death of Virgil. Augustus's bread and circuses, you know. And it's all in the first part of it, where Virgil makes that appalling journey through the slums.
And Misery Street.
To Caesar's Palace. There was a Caesar's Palace before Las Vegas. And it was probably not that different.
And then when he overhears the drunks in the street swearing and using foul language, abusing their emperor, and he knew exactly that kind of world has no interest. Human beings are very they're amazing things, but evolution hasn't been kind. Mm-hmm. It's given us just enough brain to be daft and not enough brain to be really organized. The brains can't organize the world. You can see it. They don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. The countries are too big. They've got too much responsibility. And you can see that as soon as a man is elected an emperor or prime minister, everybody conspires to stop him from doing anything. Mm. It's a bad business. So what can poor little Mozart do about that? Mm. Except, now here we come to another thing. The people talk about different cultures, but you know, there isn't any culture anymore. When I was a young man, the politicians were cultivated men. They knew about Mozart, and they knew a lot of things. But now, politicians are pretty well totally Philistine. Mm-hmm. They're interested in politics and their own climb to supreme positions, but they're not able to talk on that level with everybody who had at that time read the same things, knew the same music, could quote from Shakespeare. All of them could. I mean, that was a general culture. It's completely disappeared. Hmm. And now what do we have? We have a culture of television and celebrity, and it's more important what happens on Big Brother, which I've never seen, than whether we play a Mozart symphony. Hmm. Where that's all going to end, I just don't know. The signs are looming catastrophes, aren't they? There are too many people. There won't be enough to eat. If the ice cap melts and all the big horror stories that people are preparing for us.
What's to expect from the new Gordon Brown England, especially for those who, in retrospect, are so disappointed that Tony Blair and Britain didn't restrain George Bush and the United States in Iraq?
Well, we just don't know. We don't most of us feel that we have anyone who is a possible leader. I think Gordon Brown is an intelligent guy, but he doesn't appear so far to have a breadth of vision. He keeps getting himself into scrapes, and he doesn't seem to have the character of a man who wants to carry through something which he really believes in. I don't know whether Tony Blair believed in anything. This is a big, big tragedy. So people lost interest in politics in England. They still have. They're not interested in these guys. And it's terribly embarrassing. We don't, any of us, know what all this was about. But it may have been a feeling that England is a small island needing big friends. And never mind who the president is, you need the support of the United States. I think that's the kindest view I can put on it. But unfortunately, on your side, you didn't have somebody who was any better than Tony Blair. And between them, they have made the most appalling hash of it. And it has led to, in England, to complete skepticism about politicians. There doesn't seem to be anybody in sight who has a very, very strong belief in anything really big.
When you speak of Elgar's Dream of Gerontius, which you're conducting next, it's a piece I don't know, but it's another imagination of an old man's view of life and death and judgment and an afterlife. What is this piece about for you, and what is conducting it like?
It's about what you've just said. Even if you believe, or you don't believe, this piece is tackling a view of what might happen when each of us has to die. And I guess for most people, it's a pretty uncomfortable business. As Webster says, death, a hideous stream of terror. If you remember that awful poem, wonderful poem. Don clean linen, bathe your feet. And the foul fiend mortar check, a crucifix hang round your neck. Well, everybody's got to face it. And this is one particular view which was developed over 2,000 years, that there would be judgment after life. According to your behavior here, you would be treated over the border. There are many other views, and there are some who don't believe in any of it anyway, and death's just death, so what? And millions of people have fallen into the abyss, and you're just the next in line. It doesn't matter what you think. Elgar, Newman are tackling a problem, and it's up to you to use your imagination and to believe it with them. As you do with the Mozart Symphony, as I do with the Mozart Symphony, when it begins, I am totally in a state of belief. Thank God.
In the Elgar Gerontius, where does he spring his answer for you? Where's the punchline?
The punchline comes right at the end with that amazing, amazing consolation that he gives us with his final melody. And I suppose the the message is hope. And that is something music can do, which nobody else can.
I'm fascinated by the combination of Elgar, definitively sort of Edwardian, British. I mean, everybody knows the Pomp and Circumstance, and a lot of people know the Enigma variations, but the sort of comeback power of Elgar, and I'm associating it now with your amazing role in music in the world. I was watching you conduct, and I was thinking, my word, what a fantastically English character you are. Somebody said, you know, he's really James Bond, Colin Davis. And I was thinking, there's a little James Bond, there's a little Noel Coward, there's a little Peter O'Toole. You play so many roles, so English too, so un-Tony Blair, so further evolved from what England, you know, has seen to us politically in the last few decades. But what's to say about this 21st century Englishman?
I haven't the faintest idea. That's the answer to that. I identify with what I'm doing. And Elgar is about as much about Pomp and Circumstance as Beethoven is about his battle symphony. Or some jingoistic song Mozart wrote for the Kaiser. I mean, come on, that's not what's important about Elgar. What is so wonderful about Elgar is what is wonderful about most of these composers is they're kind of schizophrenic. They're unbelievably melancholy and insecure. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they have enormous force and confidence to get down on paper what they think. Look at Sibelius, he was riddled with self-doubt and so on, but he had the intellect, which I admire so much, to get it down on the paper. And never mind what he suffered personally. You know, there's awful stories about Sibelius. You know, his wife discovered him asleep with his head on the table, an empty whiskey bottle and the score of the Seventh Symphony. And she wrote him a letter, even though she lived in the same house, to say, I'm not coming to the first performance. Mm. And she didn't. But he still loved her. I can't, they're amazing people. Look at Mozart falling into debt. Look at him strutting about trying to keep up with the court in his dress and so on. Knowing his total intellectual superiority to any other composer who was around, and at the same time suffering a most terrible melancholy. Mm. And why I love music so much is that they bring all of these sides of themselves and the world and everybody else into a sense of order. The thing about Mozart is that it is so supremely ordered. And within that, the security of the order, he can express anything he wants. But he's got it laid out. Mm. I think that's what I mean. Whereas later on in music, things became more and more disordered, actually. But what's that got to do with me being an Englishman? I haven't any idea. I was brought up there and I speak the language and all the rest, but I've tried my best to identify with other cultures, other music. I find it difficult to get on with Russian music, I have to say. But the best of Verdi is up there with Mozart. Look at Falstaff. I mean, if Mozart could have heard Falstaff, he's there. Not bad.
What have I left out? What's the answer for which I haven't asked the question?
Why am I an Englishman? How am I an Englishman? I don't know. Perhaps I have a curious mixture of curiosity, skepticism, lust for reading, and trying to be trying to follow Broch's advice is that the most important thing in the end is common decency.
Mm. We're hugely grateful for what you do over so many years in so many different ways. We haven't even mentioned Mahler and Britten and all Tippett.
Tippett, you haven't mentioned.
Exactly.
Let alone Hector Berlioz.
Indeed. But thank you. It's a joy to watch you with the orchestra, especially to watch you with Miss Uchida. And I'm sure Mozart is pleased somewhere.
Well, I hope so too. I hope that he would say, yeah, I don't mind having a drink with these two.
Colin Davis, thank you enormously for joining us on Open Source. It's a great pleasure.
Well, it's my pleasure too.